Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
yeah, no, you know, we got a Solartopia here. That's a beautiful Dar Williams. We're singing with Pete Seeger and David Byrne on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Great to be with you today. We're going to have, in 10 minutes, we're going to be joined by the wonderful Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson will be calling us from California. She's the author of many, many, many books and a truly wonderful, powerful soul and spirit has been joined with us. I want to point out that Dar Williams, who is singing on that on the song today, has a beautiful interview at the Common Dreams. She's really terrific, somebody you really want to read about, listen to, and join in making social change. She's just a terrific human being. You'll enjoy the interview again. It's at commondreams.org. I want to talk today a bit, as we get going here, about Fukushima. Fukushima is still happening, still a major disaster there, and with fuel flying in the air. There is a spent fuel pool at Fukushima, which is 100 feet in the air, and it is vulnerable to a major earthquake at any time. If, God forbid, there should be an earthquake, well, we know there will be an earthquake. The question is, will they get the, will the Japanese government, the world community be wise enough and competent enough to get the fuel out of this fuel pool, spent fuel pool, before a, earthquake knocks it down, and we are in dire danger of this happening. Should that fuel fall to the ground, it could spontaneously ignite because of the zirconium alloy that's used to clad this spent fuel, and we could have an apocalypse, let's put it that way. The 1,300 tons or so of spent fuel that are perched in the air, in this spent fuel pool, should they fall to the ground, should they spontaneously ignite, could put out more radiation than we could ever imagine. It would go into the air, it would go into the water, of course, to a certain extent, but it would go into the air, go around the world, and kill innumerable of our fellow human beings, including many of us, many of you who are listening. This is a danger that is not to be understated. In the last few weeks, we've had unending bad news in Fukushima. The radiation bubbles that are pouring into the ocean are without precedent, unfortunately. They're continuing to occur. And, you know, the powers that be like to say, well, it'll be diluted by the Pacific Ocean, won't really harm us. Don't pay the slightest bit of attention to that. We have been seeing radioactive tuna caught off the coast of California. Clearly radiation Fukushima coming all the way here. We are having, in the last, I believe it was about 10 days ago, a great hero, the man who stood his ground, refused to retreat, and ran Fukushima through the crisis to the best of 51, stayed there, did everything in his power to minimize catastrophe. He has died. I posted an article about him at www.newsfree.org. He has passed away. We are starting to see, continuing to put it that way, major releases radiation into the thyroid. Thyroid building in the Fukushima area. It is ongoing. And this idea that we're going to continue to operate nuclear plants and somehow they will be safe is simply an illusion. We've also had a report that about a dozen of the 100 remaining commercial reactors in the United States are on special watch from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. These reactors are getting older and older. There is nothing new, nothing safe about the designs of them, and they continue to threaten us. We, on the other hand, continue to threaten them. We have an active and a powerful anti-nuclear movement in the country, a no-nuke movement that is continuing on the case. You can read about it regularly at www.nukefree.org, which I edit, posting links to the major and important articles of the day that continue to break the ongoing saga of nuclear power and the conversion of renewable energy. It's sort of a parallel universe because the news from nuclear power, industry, except for the shutdown, is universally bad. And the news from the renewable business is actually almost steadily good, even better than expected. For example, the country of Thailand has just set up a program to install 1,000 megawatts of new solar energy. Very, very good development, very powerful stuff. There are feed-in tariffs, which are being installed in other places around the country and around the world, which facilitate the spread of renewable energy. We have had some setbacks with some substandard photovoltaic cells coming from China, where they're mass-producing them and not really taking care to produce the best quality stuff. But on the whole, the renewable energy revolution, the Mars Solartopia, is proceeding very, very quickly. There's every indication that it's going to come in ahead of schedule and under budget, that we will be successfully converting to a green powered Earth where we get our electricity and our other sources of energy from solar, from wind, from tidal, from geothermal, from ocean thermal, from biomass, from increased conservation, increased efficiency, the spread of mass transit, the spread of bicycles, for God's sake. All this stuff is happening very, very quickly. And it's our job as environmentalists, as solartopians, as listeners to the Progressive Radio Network, that we shut these atomic reactors as fast as we possibly can and continue to push very, very hard for the conversion to renewable energy. It is happening. It will happen. It has to happen for us to survive on this planet, and that's the reality that we face. So that's the theme of this Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show week after week. And the news continues to be schizophrenically mixed. From Fukushima and elsewhere, from all the nuclear plants, it is bad. And from the spread of renewable energy, from the solar business, from wind, which is now going to be, there's been a major breakthrough in wind power in terms of deployment offshore, and this is going to be a major deal. From Maine has been launched a windmill that will work in the ocean, a big one, and it does not have to be anchored to the ocean floor. This is going to revolutionize the field of offshore wind, going to make it much, much more powerful, more available, cheaper, cleaner, safer, more reliable, and this is something that we can all look forward to in our lifetime. We will see huge deployment of windmills in the Great Lakes, especially Great Lake Erie, and along with both shores of this country, the East Coast and the West Coast. And it's an exciting development that we can all really, really look forward to, invest in, reap the benefits of, and just move everything that much faster to a green-powered Earth. We are all part of this. It is a joy and honor, a privilege to be part of this movement that's affecting the conversion to Solartopia, and I'm looking forward to being ever more a part of it. Now, a big part of this whole changing mindset has been an amazing woman, someone I've had the honor to know for many years. Her name is Marianne Williamson. You have probably heard of her. She's written many, many, many books. She conducts, well, I'll let her introduce herself here. She's joined us. She's on the line. Marianne, are you with us?
I am.
Well, it's wonderful to hear your voice.
It's wonderful to hear yours. Thank you for having me on your program.
Well, it's my honor. I will be on with you tomorrow. Can you, just before we lose track of it, can you tell our listeners what the program is tomorrow and how they can get involved with it?
Well, we did a marvelous event last November called Sister Giants, about women and nonviolence and birthing a new American politics. And we had 1,500 women gathered here in Los Angeles, and we had women represented from all 50 states. About 500 women were watching on the internet, and it was the main focus here has to do with encouraging women to run for office, but it also has to do with understanding on a deeper level the issues that are involved for anybody as a political activist or a political candidate. So we have a conference call every month, and we are honored to have you tomorrow night on our Sister Giant call. People can go to sistergiant.com to learn more about it. It will be at 6 p.m. Los Angeles time, West Coast time, 9 p.m. East Coast time. And we're going to be discussing with you primarily all issues having to do with nuclear energy, but particularly the idea of whether or not we even need it and what the scoop is, as it were, regarding the domestic use of nuclear energy. So we have marvelous people such as yourself that we talk to every month, and we learn from you and have a good time.
Wonderful, Megan. And I just want to let people know that you are absolutely a pleasure, a joy. You're a brilliant woman, very concise, very entertaining and enjoyable to talk to. And I want to talk to you now about what I believe. Well, let's first of all celebrate something. Since we're going to be talking tomorrow about nuclear, is there a way people can call in?
Yes, how does that work? And first of all, thank you for the kind things that you just said about me, Harvey. The admiration is mutual. If people go to sistergiant.com, they're on the homepage. It gives the number to call in tomorrow for the conference call.
Sistergiant.com.
You got it.
Oh, I love that. That's very cool. All right. I do want to say that, among other things, we will be talking about nuclear, that we will be celebrating, as we have on this show many times. But you can't, huge victories, you can't celebrate them too much. And so we are going to be celebrating the step-down of San Onofre Units 2 and 3. We will have the honor of saying once again that there will be no Fukushima.
Harvey, I'm having a little bit of a difficult time hearing you, so if there's a way you can talk a little more into the phone or something.
Okay, we can do that. How's that?
Yeah, that is better. Thank you. So what was the last thing you were saying?
Well, we were saying that there will be no Fukushima at San Onofre. There are three retired reactors on the I-5 between L.A. and San Diego on the beach. And they will, unit one we set in the 90s, and units two and three will not reopen.
Great. And large part because of you. Thank you very much. All Californians are grateful to you.
I do have a vested interest. My grandson lives in Los Angeles. He's 1 year old.
Aww.
And it is my duty to protect him and all other grandchildren, not to mention children, and ourselves. And so the point is to celebrate our victory and understand that we do win. And Marianne, you are an inveterate winner. And what I believe is your most recent book is The Law of Divine Compensation. Is that correct?
That's my most recent, yep.
And tell us a bit about this. The Law of Divine Compensation, the subtitle is On Work, Money, and Miracles. Now, I have read this book. It's a lovely little I have a hardback, but it's a nice size. It's very easy to read, and I have zipped through it. And tell us a bit about what this book is about, if you would.
Well, I'd be glad to do that, but are we going to circle back around to San Onofre and all of that, or can we talk a little bit about that now? I mean,
let's continue to talk about San Onofre, because if we don't, we know each other well enough, we're going to have a lasting conversation, and at the end we're going to say, we didn't do it.
Yeah, I think that there's a very big, very significant issue there. And that has to do with the fact that the people spoke. It has to do with the fact that the will of the utilities companies and all of that was not ultimately as loud as the voice of the people. And I think that that's particularly important for all of us to remember, at a time when democracy itself seems not only under assault in various ways, but at a time when people tend to be so cynical and even hopeless about the ability of the people of the United States to override corporate interests. And this is so significant. You know, I spoke at a conference this weekend, Harvey, for an organization called Results. Results is a marvelous citizens lobby that works against the worst ravages of hunger and poverty, both domestically and around the world. And there was a panel, and somebody was talking about how some people these days just feel resigned. Since Citizens United, they feel like, you know, the fix is in. There's nothing we can do. It would take a constitutional amendment to override corporate personhood. That it's just, you know, people are just feeling resigned and hopeless. And my point was that we as citizens need to get our mojo back. We need to redevelop the musculature of democracy. You know, what if the abolitionists had said, it's too hard? You know, what if the women's suffrage had said, it's just too hard? You know, I mean, come on. You know, let us not be the generation where everything goes down because it was just too hard. And I think that when we see, like you said, we want to celebrate the wins. You know, it's like when you have a compromised immune system. The problem with a compromised immune system is not just that there are assaults in the form of bacteria or virus. There are always bacteria and virus throughout the body. The issue is the immune system strong and vital? And I think that's true in society as well. But there will always be, until we reach total enlightenment, there will be forces out to resist and to limit the practice of real liberty and freedom on a universal level. The issue is that every citizen is a kind of cell in the immune system of the body of the population. And so we have to be concerned as much with any compromise to the immune system as we have to be concerned with whatever disease might enter the body. And I think that that's what you certainly represent, and certainly what all the entire movement having to do with San Onofre represented, which was people who are saying, despite the temptation that many of us have sometimes to think one person can't make a difference. You know, no great social movements occur because of just one person. But one person can catalyze a movement. It's a kind of pod theory. One person doesn't just carry their own energy forward. They ignite enthusiasm among other people. And we all are part of a field. It's a collaborative venture. And I think that that's really the impulse of this moment, not just with nuclear energy, not just with San Onofre, but really across the board. And I feel rumblings. I assume that you feel that way too, Harvey. I think that I'm sure you feel that in many ways some of your own work is coming to fruition. I love the line. Now, some people say that Churchill did not say this, but I had always read that Churchill did say that you can always count on Americans to do the right thing after they have exhausted every other possibility.
Yes, and I think he also said democracy is the worst form of government ever invented except for all the other ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading that one. So the point is that we sometimes are slow to wake up. We are slow to kind of stick our heads up and look around and go, what the hell is going on here? But throughout our history, we have tended to do that, even if it's at the last, you know, at the 11th hour. We do tend to get there. And when Americans do wake up and when the democratic impulse is vital in the United States, we kick ass. And I think that we're living at a time when there's some real potential in the air because people are waking up and are participating in organizations such as yours, such as, you know, nonukes.org. And I think that this is a real pregnant moment.
Well, we're talking with Mary Ann Williamson, as you can tell, an inveterate butt picker herself, a woman who speaks in terms of spirituality and manages to translate that into both political action and the successful, shall we say, service of wealth, or the, well, how would you say it? Not accumulation of wealth. This is what your book is about. This one here, The Law of Divine Compensation. But let's dwell for a minute on what did happen at San Onofre, because I will say, you know, having done this for 40 years, and a bit of an ability to scan the landscape, that as of January, Edison, Southern California Edison, had a clear path to gouging the ratepayers and forcing the restart of the San Onofre reactors 2 and 3, however much it would have cost, which was going to be a lot. And because citizens rose up, it didn't happen. And what you're saying here about a pregnant moment is exactly right. Well, not we actually had that baby. We had the two of them there. The double victory at San Onofre, and those two reactors are among the four that have been shut in this country this year, the other two being Crystal River in Florida and Kewaunee in Wisconsin. And none of those shutdowns would have happened had citizens not risen up. And so what you're saying, Marianne Williamson, is, hey, look around us. We can make this difference, can't we?
Well, I think what's so interesting is that you can look at any issue that confronts us today, and there are the appropriate efforts. There are the appropriate projects. There are the appropriate breakthrough solutions. We just need to step it up. And I think that's very important. You can find any issue. Take something like nuclear energy. You've got your own work. On any issue, there are already people doing the work that needs to be done to override, you know, the moneyed interests or any other institutional interests that would keep solutions at bay. But I think people don't recognize always how significant and important it is for any individual to join the effort. Because when you have as much money arrayed and as many material resources arrayed in support of the resistance to the breakthroughs, the only thing that can compensate for that is human energy, human passion, human involvement. You know, it sounds trite to say it, but the democratic spirit. And
right.
So, yeah, I'm feeling hopeful, and I think it's so important when we have situations like San Onofre that people see this is an example of what happens when democracy gets the final word.
Absolutely. And it's impossible to overestimate how important these victories are. When, you know, I began the show, Marianne, talking about Fukushima, and San Onofre was a key, a very clear candidate for another Fukushima. It's right on the ocean, surrounded by earthquake faults, in a tsunami zone, for God's sakes. And we have avoided that. And, you know, I get the great joy and benefit of waking up every morning knowing that, you know, I was a part of this great movement. And it's... Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. For myself, one of the most compelling things I heard you say that there are those who had argued that we didn't have to see Chernobyl as some specter and warning because that was an old piece of, you know, it was an old reactor built under the Soviets. But when
right.
you pointed out that Fukushima was built by General Electric, and that General Electric is who builds ours now, and that when you're talking about a tsunami, when you're talking about just possibilities of human error, the risk that is entailed, even when General Electric does build a nuclear reactor, the inherent risk of having one. And as you said, right there on the Pacific Ocean, near the San Andreas Fault. I mean, it's, you know, it reminds me of when Mahatma Gandhi said that the problem with the world is that humanity is not in its right mind. I mean, you really wonder if anybody is sane to build a nuclear facility near the San Andreas Fault. So, and now the bigger issue, if correct me if I'm wrong, the bigger issue is, do we need domestic use of nuclear energy at all? Now, didn't I hear you say that it's only 20%? Did I hear you say it's 20% or 8% of our energy usage?
Well,
energy?
It's actually both. It's 20% of our electricity, and it's 8% of our total energy.
Okay, so let's take that in for a minute. It's 20% of our electricity. It's 8% of our total energy
yeah.
usage.
Right.
Now, isn't your argument that with green and renewables that there's just really no need for it at all?
Totally useless. It's extraneous. There's absolutely no need for a single electron to come from nuclear power or ultimately from coal, oil, or gas, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nuclear, and gas. Basically, that day is done. And we're in the midst of the greatest technological revolution in terms of energy in human history since the invention of fire. I mean, it's literally true.
So what do you say to those who say there's simply not enough time, that the renewables can't sort of get up to speed fast enough at this point to be able to overtake, to compensate for all of our energy needs? Is that just a myth?
I can reply with something I couldn't have said a month ago, which is, what about Walmart, for God's sakes? Walmart is converting all their big boxes to renewable energy by 2020. And they will, I guarantee you, they'll be ahead of schedule. You know, now if they'd only pay their workers decently, but nonetheless, all the big box stores are going to renewables. It's mind-boggling. And the whole history of renewables is it exceeds expectations. It's pretty amazing, actually. Virtually every renewable facility that you read about, that you follow, that you study, comes in ahead of schedule and under budget. It seems to be the nature of the technology.
Nuclear
is the opposite.
I think many people, particularly young people, are not aware that President Jimmy Carter had a solar panel on top of the White House. He was president from 76 to 80, and when Reagan was elected in 1980, one of his first acts was to remove the solar panel. Isn't that correct?
Yes, it is absolutely correct. And one of the big disappointments with Bill Clinton, aside from the fact, or in addition to the fact that he failed to free Leonard Peltier, is that Clinton never put panels back on the White House. But you know who solar heated the White House pool?
Who?
George W. Bush.
Really?
And Bush actually has quite a bit of solar energy at his ranch in Crawford.
Really?
Now, but Marianne, as I'm sure you know, the utility industry is petrified of renewable energy. And there's been a major report done by the Edison Institute, warning that renewable energy could spell the end of the utility industry, and more power to it, for God's sake.
Exactly. Well, but then I have two questions for you. First of all, just a little anecdote that I don't know if you know. I just got back from Washington, D.C. Did you know that Bill Clinton's name, that the new Environmental Protection Agency building actually is going to be named the Bill Clinton building?
No.
Yeah.
Well...
Anyway,
I'd actually prefer that they name it after Monica Lewinsky, but what can I tell you?
There was some energy expended there. So let me ask you a question. So that's very interesting what you just said about George Bush. I think with political parties, it's not the black and white situation that it kind of used to be, or maybe we thought it was, or whatever.
Let me just say and. Marianne, you reach so many people that renewable energy will be the biggest industry in the history of the world. Every building, every parking lot, every vehicle, every machine, every device will have photovoltaic cells on it. All of us will be driving electric cars that will be powered from our homes within 10 years. I mean, you know, we are witnessing an enormous technological transformation. And it's all about the photovoltaic cell. And there is some mystical, magical, but, you know, tangible and economic feature in the conversion of photons to moving electrons that is going to is in the process of transforming this world.
Is that when you say that it will all be within 10 years, does that mean, do we have 10 years?
Well, that's up to us. So that's our task. That's our anxiety. That's our, you know, real urgency, is to get these reactors shut as fast as we possibly can, and to curtail global warming as fast as we possibly can, so that we do have the time to make this transition. That's our challenge.
Now, what about nuclear warfare? What about nuclear bombs? Can you, I realize that even though theoretically you're interviewing me today and I'm interviewing you tomorrow, I find myself asking one of the questions. What about nuclear bombs, and what are we going to do about those?
Well, you know, Marianne, let's take a short break. We want to hear my friend Dana Lyons sing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song.
Great.
And we will come back to the question of nuclear war in just a moment after a few announcements and stuff like that, all right?
Okay. Thank you.
Wonderful. All right, we are going to take a break now. Be right back with you.
New plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma.
Progressive Radio Network is now on iTunes. search for us to listen and download past shows or get them updated automatically. Just type Progressive Radio Network in the search bar and download any show free of charge. Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
It's the BRONX. You know what's next.
It's a bowl of soul.
Sweet soul.
And get your dose of classic soul and independent R&B music from the United States and abroad on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A Bowl of Soul is a music experience you won't forget or regret. Check out A Bowl of Soul on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Dr. Jack Rasmus, your host for the Alternative Vision Show on the Progressive Radio Network. Alternative Visions interviews guests from grassroots America. The show's topics address the continuing economic and political crises in America. Alternative Visions differs from most radio shows. The focus is not only on understanding the crises, but discussing ideas on what can be done about it. Alternative Visions airs every Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. And if you don't catch us live, you can still listen 24/7 on the PRN website. Once again, that's PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24/7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at prn.fm. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
Yes, indeed. Solartopia is home sweet home. To me, that's the wonderful, fabulous David Dana Lyons of Cows with Guns fame, singing the Solartopia Rocky Top version. We're on with Marianne Williamson, author of God knows how many books, literally, and one of the great thinkers and activists of our time. Marianne, you with me?
Yes, I am. And guess
all right,
what?
All right.
Now, while we were off the line, do you know that that the Duchess of Cambridge had her baby?
Mazel tov.
Yeah, she had a boy.
A boy. So I'm sure the London Times will have a big mazel tov on the front page.
Absolutely.
And is he now the next king of England?
This little boy is the third in line.
Third in line. All right. Well, we'll see what happens here.
Yeah. Well, this is how he's a big environmentalist, like his grandfather. I have to say, you know, Prince Charles, when it comes to all of these issues about renewable energy and organics and sustainability, he's really quite the leader. Did you realize how much he is?
Well, tell me a bit. I know a bit, but let's hear it.
Yeah, I saw this movie called Harmony. It was made by Julie Bergman and her husband, Stuart Sender. And they made a movie called Harmony, and it includes a lot of Prince Charles. And I had known that he was interested in sustainability, but I had not realized until I saw that movie what a real leader he is and really deeply involved in all issues of sustainability. I was very impressed, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and now, you know, Great Britain, since we've been talking nuclear, as we are wont to do on this show, Great Britain has been talking about building new reactors. And I don't know where he stands on it. I haven't heard him outright oppose, but I would assume if he's a serious environmentalist that he will be in the opposition with us. But, yes, Prince Charles has been pretty active over the years, and as has the other, I think, most important guy in England, Paul McCartney, who will be playing in San Francisco for Greenpeace in August, actually, August 9th. There's a major concert in San Francisco. It will feature Sir Paul. And Sir Paul has talked about, I don't call him Sir Paul, actually, since I grew up, as I'm sure you did with the Beatles, he is a vegetarian and a very strong, outspoken vegetarian. After his wife, unfortunately, passed away, Linda Eastman. Mm-hmm. She was an amazing person. They started a line of vegetarian food.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that I don't know your situation with vegetarianism, Marianne, but we talk a lot about global warming, and we'll get to a nuclear war, by the way, which is where we left it prior to the break. But the issue of meat and industrial meat production is very deeply entwined with global warming. There are many people who believe, many scientists who believe, that the effects of industrial meat production are actually on a par with burning fossil fuels. Have you seen any of that?
Oh, yes. I've been told, anyway, that if everybody stopped eating meat, that would actually be a more powerful step forward than if everybody stopped driving a car. Is that true?
Yes, it is true. There are a number of reasons, actually. First of all, I know this is a family show, but we can talk about cow flatulence, I think. You know, the feeding of beef cows and milk cows, because they have four stomachs, they are major, major methane emitters. And, you know, this huge proliferation of literally millions, tens of millions of beef cows and milk cows has an enormous impact on the environment, on the atmosphere, on a par with all the automobiles being driven in the world. It's astonishing but true. And then, of course, with the raising of meat, you also have the stripping of the Amazon, the consumption by beef and dairy animals, through no fault of their own, of about 90% of the grain that's raised in the United States. Do you know that? All the corn, the soy, the barley, the millet, the rye, the wheat, is mixed in grains that are fed to fatten cows and to, you know, increase milk production. It's staggering.
Well, I remember the book Diet for a New America.
Yes, and prior to that was Diet for a Small Planet.
Right.
By Francis Kay, which really affected me in the 1970s.
Yeah.
But the conversion to a vegan diet, or at least to a vegetarian diet that might include fish, would be a gargantuan step forward, not only for combating global warming, but also for combating hunger, for God's sakes. We could feed the entire planet many times over overnight if we took away the grain that was being fed to cows and gave it instead to human beings.
Explain to me about chicken. Where does chicken come into all that?
Well, there's too much grain being fed to chickens. And chickens also are being kept under the most incredibly inhumane conditions, especially here in Ohio.
That I do know. I'm on the religious advisory board for the Humane Society, and the conditions for the chickens and the, you know, it's like the puppy mills and what they do with the chickens. I know it's very immoral,
horrible.
And I think there's such an uprising of moral concern for the way we treat animals.
Oh, it's absolutely horrifying. But I will say, on the behalf of chickens, that if we raised chickens, not only to be range-fed, but also to have them loose in our gardens and in our, you know, among our crops, our food crops, chickens are really, really good at eating harmful bugs.
And eating, what did you say, harmful bugs?
Harmful bugs.
Wow.
And the way to really make the maximum use of chickens is to put them in fields and in gardens and just let them loose, and we don't need pesticides. I mean, you know, they are the ultimate purveyor of managing bugs. It's a great thing. But that's, unfortunately, that is not the chicken we get. I mean, if you get range-fed chicken, that's one thing, but really hard to come by and very, ironically, very, very expensive, which ironically, because we don't grain feed them. And so they should be cheaper to raise, but they're not. Not the way the current agriculture is set up. And sooner or later, you know, there's a huge avoidance of this issue. You know, I love Bill McKibben's work, and I love everything that 360 has done. But to fight the burning of fossil fuels without also fighting at least industrial meat production, you don't have to advocate vegetarianism. You know, I haven't eaten meat since 1970, but I would consider eating buffalo. You know, because they're natural. They range. They don't require grain or anything like that. They belong in the prairie.
Well, wait a minute. What do they eat? What do buffalo eat that's different?
They eat the switchgrass.
They eat what?
Grass.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, the buffalo really belong out there. They're the natural animal. We should be raising three crops in the Great Plains. Between the Mississippi and the Rocky Mountains, we should be raising buffalo, hemp, and wind power. Those are the three great crops of the Great Plains. And all these cows that are being stuck in CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations, you know, feedlots, it's horrifying. And it is killing the planet. There's no doubt about it. It's killing the planet every bit as effectively as the burning of fossil fuels.
Is there any kind of congressional action that is ever submitted that would in any way impact that?
Yeah, all in the wrong direction. I mean, these feedlots, these cattle operations, these, you know, these ranges of big cattle ranches, they are all subsidized. And not only are they subsidized, Marianne Williamson, but they're also supported by the government-sponsored killing of wolves and, you know, other natural creatures out there. And they're also supported, not too long, well, let's go on and on. I mean, they're also supported by the subsidies that are used to plow up the prairie. You know, one of the greatest ecological disasters in human history was the migration of farmers into the Great Plains. Because when the first thing they did when they got there was to plow up the natural grass, which, you know, the sod. Some of it they made houses on, and other words, they just discarded, and they bared the earth, and then they put in wheat and soy and corn and all these other monocrops. And, you know, the first bad year, everything died, and you wound up having exposed earth, and you did that long enough. You drove away the clouds, you brought on drought, and you brought on the dust storms. And, the 1920s, early 30s dust storms were among the major human-produced catastrophes in human history. So, and now I got to tell you that we're flirting with disaster now because, because the farms that are supported, the major ranches, the huge monogrowth of soy and corn primarily and wheat and barley, which is going to fat cows, is supported by the draining of the Ogallala Aquifer. You know, there's a gargantuan underground, almost freshwater ocean underneath the Great Plains, and we are using that to irrigate these crops. And that ain't going to last forever. And so, you know, our backup plan here of using irrigation to prevent a dust storm is going to run its course, and then we're really going to be in deep trouble.
When will that happen?
Soon. I'm not sure. I think they're avoiding studying that. Well, it's hard to tell. I don't know if they really know how deep the Ogallala Aquifer is, but it's huge. It's underneath. It stretches pretty much from southern Minnesota all the way down to Oklahoma. But if and when it runs out, you know, we got no backup. The only backup plan we got is the one we should be doing now, which is to plant the whole Great Plains in hemp, which doesn't need that kind of watering. And that will also be a major energy crop and a huge food source. And, you know, I think, Marianne, there's great oil in hemp seed. and the stalks are good building material, and the leaves and all the other stuff can be used for paper and for clothing and all that stuff. So, and it certainly will help mitigate global warming. You'll be happy to know, Marianne, that in my neighboring state of Kentucky, which may become the first to legalize industrial hemp in a big way, the two primary advocates of legal hemp are Senator Mitch McConnell and Senator Rand Paul. I love that.
They are supporting it.
Supporting legalized industrial hemp, yes.
And tell me what all the legalized industrial hemp would be used for.
Well, right now, legalized hemp is a $500 million crop in Canada. It's legal in China, in Japan, in Romania, in Germany, all across Europe. And it's used, as Ben Franklin used it, for paper. It's much better paper, by the way, than trees make. And you get five times as much paper from an acre of hemp as you do from trees with minimal, you don't have to water it. You don't have to fertilize it. You don't even have to spray it. Hemp appears to have no major predators in the insect world. I guess they eat it and they get stoned or something. But you also use it for clothing. There's a tremendous quantity of clothing made in China and elsewhere from hemp, especially canvas shoes. Well, you know, the root of the word canvas is cannabis,
right,
or vice versa, which, of course, is based on the hemp plant, which has been used for 6,000 years. Medicines, there are a tremendous amount of medicine involved with the hemp plant. Well, that's primarily the THC, the marijuana plant, but it's the same family. The hemp stalks are extremely strong, not quite as strong as bamboo, but very, very usable in housing, usable especially for insulation. It makes a great insulation, much better than fiberglass. And this is, of course, the stuff you don't smoke. There are no viable arguments against legalizing industrial.
So why was it ever outlawed?
Well, there's two reasons, and you're going to have to come back on my show, Marianne, because I don't want to talk to you, but we can have this discussion. I'm happy to do it. Everybody loves to hear talking about hemp because it is very much a part of the Solartopian revolution. Hemp was made illegal. There are all sorts of conspiracy theories. The two major ones, well, the number one, and which I think is quite viable, actually, is that the Hearst family, which owns the newspapers and has, of course, were the major media barons among the robber barons at the turn of the last century, owned and continues to own, I believe, huge forests, which they wanted used for paper. And everybody knew that hemp made superior paper, but they wanted to sell their forests and cut down the trees and make the money. And so there's some people who believe, and I've, all these books about marijuana, there's some people who believe that that's why marijuana was made illegal. It was the other way around, that the Hearst family wanted hemp banned so that they could make paper from trees, and their trees. And so they just went ahead and used that as a pretext for banning marijuana as well. And, of course, they used their newspapers to spread all the nonsense about, the addictive, alleged, falsely addictive properties of marijuana, which don't exist really in a physical world. So also, there are so many products that come from hemp that it was believed that some of the major corporations had other vested interests in keeping hemp illegal, but primarily had to do with paper. And if we converted to hemp paper, as was the first version of the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp paper, and there's some say that the first version of the Constitution was written on hemp paper. It is way sturdier. It is much, much stronger, and as I mentioned, way more ecologically simpatico to grow than using trees. And so that is the conspiracy theory, which I think has some weight, that it was the use of trees for paper as opposed to hemp that was one of the major reason it was made illegal. So the law is now changing. North Dakota, many of the farm states are pushing. There's a very strong Farm Bureau constituency that wants hemp legalized. The only argument you ever hear today for why hemp, industrial hemp is illegal is that would make law enforcement looking for marijuana plants would be confused, but, and you could hide marijuana in the hemp fields. This turns out to be absolutely false, because if you, as it turns out, if you plant marijuana in among hemp plants, the hemp plants will overpower the marijuana and actually convert the marijuana into unsmokable hemp, not the other way around.
Wow.
And so there's literally no reason whatsoever to make hemp illegal. But, you know, and other countries, like I say, Canada exports $500 million worth of hemp into the United States, for God's sake. And we import all these hemp, this hemp clothing from China. It's ridiculous. But I think it will go, you know, in the next 5 years or so, the money, that the huge amounts of money, it would be instantly a multi-billion dollar crop, hemp. In fact, Marianne, hemp will be within 10 years, I will guarantee this, a bigger dollar volume crop than marijuana, because the massive uses of hemp are just so profitable and so widespread that there's just no holding it back. So there you go. There's it's not what I expected to talk with you about today.
Well,
but we can talk about it tomorrow, too, on our call.
It's same conversation, isn't it? Well, we didn't talk about
it. It is.
Yeah.
I got to tell you really quickly, in raising the consciousness and doing the kinds of transformations that you, Mary Ann Williamson, talk so much about, the hemp plant seems to be center stage, along with the photovoltaic cell. And there is some major magical spiritual quality to the hemp plant that is at the core of this changeover of consciousness.
What's so interesting is how sometimes things become illegal for reasons that we don't even know. It's been so many generations. And we, you know, like what you were talking about, the Hearst family and wanting to sell their own trees to be used for producing paper and so forth. I mean, it's sometimes when you look at how something became outlawed to begin with, it becomes much easier to realize that it doesn't have to remain outlawed. And, of course, it works the other way also, which is that some of the things which are legal, why should they be legal considering the harm that they do? But just the fact something being legal or being illegal already carries so much power that changing it sometimes is not so easy. And I think also, you know, we live in at a time when we have what I call a culture of distraction, you know, the assault of modernity, makes it very difficult for people to kind of think through all the clutter that's out there. And that's why people like yourself, you know, I think the popularizer has a very important role in today's society, which is very different than the propagandizer. You know, the propagandizer is someone who takes whatever the facts are and spins them in whatever way, sometimes to the detriment of accuracy completely, in order to get a message out. The popularizer is someone who actually does know what the facts are, is looking at the facts as they exist, and makes the effort to simplify them enough. You know, and there's a difference between simple and simplistic, not to in any way decrease the truth of what's being said, but to actually increase the clarity of what's being said. And I think of you that way. You know, that's why I always appreciate you, Harvey, because not only are you doing this work, but you do the work in a way that even I can understand. You know, we don't all have the time or the intellectual, you know, bandwidth to become experts in every on every topic. But when we meet people such as yourself, who we know shares the values that we share about an issue and have done all their intellectual homework, have done all their activist work, and then can explain to us, number one, what's really true, what's going on, and how can we participate. That's a really big deal today, a really big deal today. We don't have enough of that, so thank you very much for what you do.
Well, thank you, Mary Ann Williamson, and you are an inspiration. And also, you know, I got to say, I sped through this book you have just published, The Law of Divine Compensation. And, you know, we all struggle with money, and in your case, this is a beautiful, beautiful exposition of the spirituality of money. And I'd like to hear you say a bit about it. I am going to demand, absolutely require, that you come back on the show.
Okay. Well, I'll be glad to do that, and I'll give you just a little thumbnail sketch. The idea of the Law of Divine Compensation is the idea that we are often tempted to meet limited circumstances with limited thoughts. You know, things happen in our lives with money, with work, and with everything, where things we wish hadn't happened happened, or things that we wanted to happen didn't happen. But the worst thing is when we meet that unfortunate circumstance with the thoughts that actually conspired to make it worse. Let's say somebody lost money, an investment went south, they lost their job or whatever. The biggest problem is when we meet it with a complete ain't it awful mentality. Oh, it's so terrible, they're not hiring anybody, I'll never find a job. Even when they start hiring, it won't be for a while. When they hire people, they won't be hiring people my age, they'll never let me have a job, all that kind of stuff. So the idea of metaphysical power is drawing on the reserves in our own psyche, our psychology, our emotion, even our spirituality, to compensate by knowing that we can meet limited circumstances with unlimited thought. And those unlimited thoughts have to do with the fact that, as I described this one aspect of the way the universe operates, what I call the law of divine compensation, is the idea that whenever there is lack or diminishment on the material plane, that on the non-material plane, there is such an infinity of substance as to compensate for that lack. It's kind of like a GPS. If you take the wrong turn, the GPS will automatically recalibrate. So in a universe that is self-organizing the same way an embryo becomes a baby, a bud becomes a blossom, an acorn becomes an oak tree, how every cell is programmed to turn into the next best manifestation. Even if we do have a quote-unquote bad investment, we lose our job, we're out of the money, the universe itself is programmed to compensate for any lack. If we live in the present, if we're positive, if we're loving, if we're forgiving of ourselves and others, if we hold on to anger at ourselves or others for what we feel got us into this mess, if we are holding on to the past and not being willing to really live in the full possibilities of the present, that doesn't mean we don't experience disappointment, you know. It doesn't mean we don't experience our feelings. But there's a difference between processing our feelings and indulging our feelings. There's a difference between honoring our feelings and spewing them. And that's why a lot of people are reading books like this, because we want to know how can I, in the quality of my being, be positive enough that despite whatever has happened, I'm still inviting the good things to happen now. Because you can have two people standing next to each other and they both lost their job, but one of them has such a downer attitude that they can't let go, that they will have less of a probability of attracting the new work. And that's what
let me read a paragraph from your book here in the beginning. If you think of yourself as being at the effect of a random universe that does not care about you, then you will experience your life that way. If you think of yourself as being at the effect of a loving universe that does care about you, then you will experience your life that way. I love that.
Well, that really does really say it all, because it, you know, Einstein, you'll see at the beginning of the book, there's a quote from Albert Einstein which says, the most important decision you'll ever make is whether you think you live in a friendly or hostile universe.
That's an amazing quote. And Marianne, you are definitely the purveyor of a friendly universe. We are down to our last minute here. We're going to talk with Marianne Williamson, author of The Law of Divine Compensation on Work, Money, and Miracles, among so many other books. This one's published by Harper, which published my first book, actually, way back in 1972. Marianne, it's a joy, as always, to be with you. I am requiring that you come back, so we will schedule a time.
Well, thank you. I'd be glad to. And also, Harvey, if anybody wants to know more about my work and some things that are going to be coming up, if they go to my website at marianne.com, and particularly if people sign up on my e-list, they'll be getting word about stuff coming up.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And we'll be talking to you tomorrow and many other times. I will see you in California will dance at Santa Fe.
Thank you so much.
All right, you have a great one. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you so much to our crew at PRM. .fm. We will be back next week to talk with the great Bob McChesney in a follow-up on corporate control of the media and how all that is shaping the dollarocracy that controls our country. This has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman at WWPRM.fm.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve, or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.